I am a weary-headed, lonesome traveler. I've been a-traveling on.
Barbara, I am so honored to be speaking with you right now. Thank you. And one of my favorite descriptors of you is nightclub owner, record producer, social activist, and hellraiser at large.
Well, that last part is true, for sure. all those things happened. I'm 91 years old, so a lot of stuff happens. Nice to be here. I have not spent much time in your part of the country, but I did used to once in a while go up to Minnesota, Minneapolis, and back when the Vietnam War was on, and there was a lot of Honeywell action going on then, and I kept getting invited. Anyway, hello there, Minnesota.
Well, you're from the Midwest, originally from Michigan.
Oh, they call it Detroit.
Detroit.
My parents did. They came from Arkansas, and the way they pronounce it was Detroit. I was born and raised there. I left there right after the Henry Wallace campaign.
You started singing at demonstrations for racial equality in Detroit in the 40s, out of high school.
Yeah, well, before that, though, I was always jamming with, whatever little high school groups I could find, bands, they're high school garage band type of things. Go sing a couple songs. That's where I kind of cut my pop chops, and then Pete Seeger came to town after I got out of the service and was starting this thing called People's Songs. And he was putting out a little four-page bulletin, called it the People's Songs Bulletin. He went around looking for someone who would sort of build a little chapter in their town. And so he came to Detroit and recruited me. So I was all of 18, 19, and he started sending me the People's Songs Bulletin. It was wonderful for me, wonderful, because it had all kinds of information about life and what's going on, and songs, of course, lots of songs. And the songs were reflecting the life that was going on around me in Detroit, because a lot aimed at that time, at union organizing. Post-war, there was a big, big rush of union organizing. That got me started with singing in front of the shop gates and going to rallies and things like that. And then I joined a group called American Youth for Democracy, and we and some others got together and made a test case and did a big Barlam Hotel, which, I don't know if you know Detroit, but there's this big square. Barlam Hotel is right on one side of the square, and I think it's called, that hotel, a couple of years before we decided to make our test case there, had actually not allowed the great Paul Robeson to stay there. That's how discriminatory it was.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit at that time was a place you could not sit down anywhere and have a cup of coffee with a black friend, unless you went into the black neighborhood. And it was extremely, like any southern town, extremely segregated. So we had this whole test case, and they threw us out, and they didn't serve us. And then we started getting unions and church people and all that involved, and we had a picket every week, and that's where I started really singing, because I found out I could throw my voice out over the crowd and help them pick it in rhythm.
I'm gonna walk, talk with the Prince of Peace down by the riverside. Oh yeah, down by the river.
And this was a time when Black Americans couldn't play professional sports yet. School segregation was still in full effect, and here you are, this teenager who sees that it isn't right, surrounded by people who maybe we're fine with the status quo. What was inside of you? Do you know? Why were you different?
Well, my dad and mom came from Arkansas. My dad from a town called Paragould, which I found out about 30 or so years later, was even then called Klan Country by the surrounding people. And they realized it was a hot spot for that racial dynamic. And my dad was raised that way, so he had... it was normal for him to be suspect and afraid of people different from him. It took him a lifetime, but he did change after a while, and he was otherwise a very sweet and generous man and a hard worker and tried to do everything best for his kids. But I saw that he was spotting things that I absolutely couldn't accept. There was a priest, actually, he was a Catholic priest named Father Coughlin. he was on the radio every Sunday morning. You could walk down the street and everybody had it on, bursting out of the windows. And that guy was so racist, anti-Semitic, and, you know, he kind of posed as pro-labor, but it was one of Henry Ford's schemes to divide and conquer, which was pretty apparent in a whole lot of Detroit life at the time, if you could open your eyes and see it.
You're talking about your dad and his views and how he grew up. What did your family think when you started singing at protests?
I thought I was nuts. And by that time I had actually left home. I actually, over a little racist incident at home, I packed up all my stuff and left overnight, and my dad couldn't reconcile himself to that. But when I left with all this, my stuff in boxes, he's sitting in the living room with tears rolling down his cheeks, and he really had hoped that he was going to be presenting me the next year or two as a bride, you know, with a beautiful wedding, and then he could show off his progress since he came to Detroit as a barefoot farm boy, practically, and worked his way up to having a nice house. And, you know, it was a big, terrible disappointment for him. But I have to say, even after that, you know, he very quietly was supportive of me. Very quietly. I didn't realize that he was, but my mom was filtering that, you know. And I mean, real support. After I left home, it was really cold one winter, and I didn't have a good coat. Suddenly, I got a really nice, what they call a mouton coat. A mouton is the word for sheep, I guess, and which was stylish then, and it showed up, you know, and my dad had sent it to me, and then he other things like that, gestures. They loved me, and he wanted me to succeed in life, but he just couldn't grasp. He was baffled. You know, why would I want to do this? Why would I go in that direction? Why did I actually leave home and marry a Jewish refugee guy, you know, from Germany, who was not at all what you conventionally would call good-looking, didn't have a penny in his pocket, but I fell in love with him because of his politics. And for me, that's always been the guiding thing. If the person you think you're in love with shares your worldview, then you can actually, you know, let it happen. But if they don't, you're better off to walk away.
Let me be your rag doll till your Cupid doll comes. Let me be your rag doll till your Cupid doll comes. And when your Cupid doll gets here, tell her what your rag doll does.
After your experience in Michigan and moving on, your career successfully, very successfully, spans a handful of genres. You're a master of folk, blues, and jazz. You became friends with collaborators with many of the greats in those genres, and many of them pioneers, people like Lightning Hopkins, Memphis Slim, Muddy Waters, Mama Yancey, Louis Armstrong, Bob Dylan, Pete Seeger, the list goes on. Do you ever look back on your life and just say, huh, that was my life. That is wild.
Yeah, sometimes I do. But, you know, it's all those people you mentioned had something special going on, something musically or politically or just philosophically or whatever, something, some kind of special light about them that, you know, made me want to be working with them. And it may be temporary, but maybe a long-term relationship. But, yeah, what did it mean to me personally? Is that what you want to know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a few sides to that. If you're a young person trying to find your way into a profession, let's say, which I, of course, like everybody else, I thought I was going into the music profession, and I certainly did in a certain way, but by that time, I had already become so anti-establishment that I always told myself I wasn't really in the business, you know. But I had an increasing mouths to feed. I had three kids, and I had three husbands. Only the first two were completely incapable of holding up economically at their end of it. So I had a lot of people depending on me. So you keep doing what you're doing. But I also, of course, I loved the music, and who wouldn't want to work with Louis or with Earl Hines or Jack Teagarden or Muddy Waters? Or who wouldn't want to sing with them? Muddy actually. I used to sing at this place in Chicago, the Gator Horn. Gate was pretty central to folk music scene. But I used to go there and sing, and that would send, put the groceries on the table. But then after work, I would jump in my, I used to always drive my little beat up VW ragtop. I'd drive it to Chicago from California just so I'd have a car so that I could jump in the car after work and zip down to where Muddy was playing at Smitty's Corners. Smitty's Corners, by that time of night, would be two or three people sitting around drunk, and Muddy's over in the corner, and he's drinking pretty heavy. And he actually, you know, he would just say, oh, yeah, go on up, take over. You take over. So I could go up there and sing with the greatest blues band ever under those circumstances.
And how old were you at this time?
Then by 30, 31 or 2.
Yeah.
I made my first record when I was 30, so I was a late starter, but I had mm-hmm. these children and these other adventures going on.
Right.
But I loved singing with people that knew what they were doing and had their heart really in the music. And by the way, that brings me to something I always say to young people starting to try to be, to make music the center of their lives. When you find songs, you have to look for songs that say, express something about you personally. Mm-hmm. It may not seem like it, but it does, obliquely or directly. It'll be something about you. But you have to let the song take over. And by that I mean, stop looking in the mirror. Don't give a hoot and hell about how you look or even how you sound. You want to sound really good because the audience expects it and cherishes that. So you sound as good as you can, look as good as you can, but don't let that be the center of the deal. Make the song itself the center of your attention and your passion at the moment.
Now, Barbara, you are forever an activist for the underdog, for the oppressed, for the vulnerable. How has your activism changed over the years?
How has it changed? Well, by this time, I can't go out and picket anymore, and I can't march. I did go to a march about a year ago. My daughter took me and my walker. But anyway, I can't really do that anymore. So really now all I can do is sign a petition and or try to donate a little money or spread the word. Spreading the word is really important, and I do that as much as I can. Performances, I still do, you know, every few months I get up and do a real concert, and I fill it with the best that I know of right now.
I watched one from San Francisco. I think it was the San Francisco Library, and the Q&A session appeared to not be long enough for you. I feel like you wanted to be up there for another hour to talk to these people.
Oh, at least, because, you know, once you've accumulated 90 years of experience, you want to share it with younger people coming along, and they looking for guideposts and signs of this and that and how you handle what situation and all that stuff. I love to share it. You know, they can listen and learn or reject it. I don't have control over that, but I would like to at least give it out.
Yes, you better wake up, you little girl.
Wake them up.
Before you sleep too long. Hey, wake up, all you little girls. Before you sleep too long.